Brigadier Calvert, Trio 15.
Yes. Right. Well, I say that I appreciated people like Wingate, and he was rather like the Presbyterian Covenanters, and he had very strict rules to how his troops should behave. I haven't mentioned, which I ought to, his rules about how the columns should get on with the local population. He had various, I won't say theories, but instructions on this. First of all, that you should never allow a guide to command the column. If you've got a guide, you should hold him not in the front of the column, but to use him as an advisor. If you allow him to lead the column, he may do this for his own purposes. He may want to avoid villages where they don't want to be seen helping the whites, or he may be proud and want to march them through a village to show what a big shot he is, or he may fear the devils in the jungle and avoid places, and so on. And the guide has all these weaknesses. What you must do is have the guide not in front, but behind the point section near where you are. Time and again, you see through history, throughout history, the reason why a battalion didn't do something or didn't get there or didn't do this, that and the other is because they had bad guides who showed him the wrong way. Now, this appears to be an accepted excuse. Of course, it's not acceptable at all. The commander should be given a kick up the arse or fired or shot if he can't get to a place without a guide. Second thing was, we should pay for all the food we got, and which we did. We should open up little shops to obtain information, and we carried salt, because salt was a form of money. We originally had given opium, but this was taken away from us, I think quite rightly, because it might have given us a very bad name, but that also was a form of currency. We should help the villagers as much as possible. If we found any spies or anything, we shouldn't shoot them outright. We should take them along with the column for 3 or 4 days and then release them in unknown country. And there were many methods which he used in this way to teach us how to behave and so as not to make us upset the population. And I think it went, it achieved its results, because later the Japanese said, after the first Wingate operation, that the British had planted spies and agents throughout North Burma. We hadn't done so, but by our behaviour, we had left a good impression and had made us popular. And so we had, in a way, planted agents, but they were agents of like and dislike, not of belonging to some espionage network. As regards punishment, he allowed us, as often asked, to beat people, because there was no method of giving punishment to anybody who misbehaved. You could take away his tea ration. There was only if you took away his ration, he deteriorated. So the only things which he had, in fact we allowed them to have, so as we could take them away, you might say, were cigarettes and tea. And then, of course, they could very often get cigarettes from somebody else. Now, I had a problem. Now, these were young Gurkhas. I think the Gurkhas are marvellous forces, but every army in the world, every race in the world, doesn't always shine. And certain Gurkhas had run away after three fights. And I'd spoken to the Subedar Major and also to the Gurkha Company Commander. And so what I did was, I said, if you are not prepared to fight with us in this column, you must leave the column. And so I banished them from the column. I allowed them to take some rations. I said, now you get out. You can't follow us. And so they followed us at a distance for two or three days. When a deputation came to me and said certainly that was enough. And so I relented, and they came back into the Gurkhas again. And that was quite enough to stop anybody else running away. In the second operation, there was one officer, I cannot tell what the circumstances, but he felt he had to carry out a punishment on one of, he was a battalion commander, later became a brigadier, on one of his men, and he had, or had two of his men, I think it was, and had them flogged. Now again, I have found men that if they've been treated harshly, they remember it, as long as they feel it's fairly. They're proud of it, saying, what a tough show we are in. They're proud of how hard they've been treated. When I was training the SAS in Malaya, I made them go all without food, everybody, for 3 days and nights to show that it didn't matter, they could still carry on. Instead of objecting, I gave them a bloody good meal afterwards, but they were proud of the fact they'd done this and boasted to others. When the officers were blaming the men all the time, I said it was the officers' fault, and I put all the officers concerned in the 22nd SAS, when we were forming and training it, on guard duty, and made them carry out guard duty for a week. And this impressed not only them and the troops. I'd forgotten about it until I was reminded of it the other day. And they're terribly proud of having done this, had some hard treatment. And anyway, these two men went back to their platoons and behaved perfectly well, but somebody was boasted about it. And a lawyer heard about it and wanted to make some money, and so he accused the colonel of flogging these men, and became a court-martial case. And the colonel, Wingate was long dead, the colonel said he was obeying Wingate's orders, and he was dismissed, you know, the charge was dismissed. But it was sad that Wingate had to take the blame. But there it is, it's been held up against him. But it is a problem, and I get asked this when I go down to the Staff College each year for the course Morale in Battle. What do you do with, how do you administer punishments to men in the field? Well, on the whole, I can honestly say, it may have been due to the platoon commanders, the company commanders, we had very, very little cause for any form of punishment. I think it was the men administered any reprimand to anybody, any backslider, because they were all part of the same team.
What about stopping pay?
They didn't find a damn. They didn't know. They didn't expect to get any more pay again. There they were, right in the middle of the jungle. They weren't expecting to come out. They reckoned that they had chances of them coming out were very small, they felt. No, that wasn't done. We couldn't keep documents. Going through floods, we went across the Irrawaddy, which was 3/4 of a mile wide. We had to leave about 70% of our mules behind there. The only documents which were kept, which I wrote my report on after the first Wingate operation and the second Wingate operation, were the signals we had sent, and the chief clerk of the brigade had kept all these signals, and on them you could build up a story of the operations. Now, I think think everybody admitted that there was very little cause for punishment. I was talking about the Gurkhas, and I have a very high respect for the Gurkhas, as most people have. But one must remember that they are human beings, and you can test them like you can test the guards or anybody else to destruction. And the Japanese, people thought they were invincible, but as somebody said, that Wingate was the first person at that stage to prove that the Japanese were not invincible in the jungle, although the Australians in New Guinea had done this, had proved this just before we did. There are two or three points, further points about the Gurkhas. I read recently a book published about 1979 by a Gurkha officer on the history of the war in Burma, and I think it was a pretty well balanced history, more balanced than most. But he made one or two points I'd like to correct. He said that Wingate had insisted on having low-grade troops or not fully trained troops so that he could force his own ideas onto them before they had got too inured in ordinary methods. Well, I don't have any knowledge of this, recollection of this. Wingate was trying to get the best troops he could, but he was told that the Indian Army couldn't spare any troops, and I had suggested to him that he might have Anglo-Indian or Anglo-Burmese troops, because on the retreat from Burma, there's no doubt that the Anglo-Indians and the Anglo-Burmese behaved better in a way than practically anybody else. And they stayed to the last, both men and women, in their posts. And I thought that they would make a good nucleus of a good force, because they were out not only to prove themselves, because the Anglo-Indians and Anglo-Burmese tended to be despised, but also they would have knowledge of their country, and they'd have a certain amount of patriotism to the country over which we'd be fighting, which the average Englishman had not got. But this was turned down by Delhi, because they did not want to have another minority group stating its claims when the independence of India came up after the war. I think it was a pity, but eventually we got a very under-trained 3rd-2nd Burma Rifles, some of whom had only fired their recruits training course, and the officers were all very young. In my own column, I only had one officer over the age of 21, and the majority of the very young officers, second lieutenants, had not learned to speak Gurkhali. And the King's Liverpool Regiment were sent out as a garrison battalion, and they were mostly about over the age of 30, married and expecting to have a fairly stationary, docile job. Wingate did find certain officers of the Gurkhas who thought they knew best and who never took or understood or received his methods of instructions. It is of interest that Wingate chose myself and George Dunlop as column commanders of the Gurkhas and two Gurkha company commanders as column commanders. The both Gurkha columns, commanded by Gurkha officers, as British Gurkha officers, who were wildly in opposition to Wingate, failed. They got ambushed and they got dispersed. Whereas my column achieved its ends, blew the railway and did this, that and the other, and came back in dispersal groups, whereas, and George Dunlop, Royal Scots, and who'd been on the retreat from Burma with me, he brought his whole column back. He didn't disperse, and he took a month longer to get back, fought a number of operations which were unrecorded in any military history, did very well, or did better than any other column, but did not get the publicity, or you might almost call notoriety, because he arrived back after the press had had their day with the early of us who came back. George Dunlop, a very fine officer, eventually became a full colonel. The men who were the real backbone of each column were the contingents from 142 Commando. This 142 Commando I raised from the remnants of 204 mission to China, which had been at my bush warfare school, and a draft RZGHA, which was a draft to reinforce the mission in China, which had packed up. They'd had all seen action, quite a number in Syria with a commander there, and others on the retreat. And they were all taught demolitions, and that was their main job. There was about one officer and 14 men with each column. And they were the men who carried out the demolitions in each column and who were the experts at crossing rivers and many other types of things, which one, they might be said, they were combat, like combat Royal Engineers. They were a fairly wild lot, but a very, very intelligent and versatile lot, and practically all their officers were very good. It has been considered amongst us whether we couldn't have carried out the operation, blowing up parts of the operation, just with these commandos alone, with a few signalers and perhaps a few Burma rifles. We could have achieved that probably better and more easily than carrying 400 men and 100 mules in a column. But Wingate and I think Wavell were really using this as an experimental force and taking in whole battalions with Wingate's, at that time, unusual methods of tactics and strategy. The advantage of that was that when the operation was publicized and the units in both the Indian Army and the British Army in India heard that these two not at all special battalions had achieved what they had done and came out again, they said, God, if those bastards can do it, we can do it. And it gave hope and strength to all these people who thought that the Japanese were invincible. So to that extent, it was rather a good thing that we went in with these very, I wouldn't say untrained, because Wingate trained them, but young or old and not very soldier-like units. Commanding a Gurkha column, I can't say too much for them. They did very well indeed, but they were very often out of their depths. And the young officers, again, did very well, but they had the minimum knowledge of warfare. 142 Commando came out, and again they formed the nucleus of the training of Wingate's brigades. And they should take great credit for what they did. This operation has been written a lot about, so I'm only choosing certain aspects which haven't been touched on. I sometimes wonder whether I should have carried out this dispersal program, because these young officers were so young, and it's a tremendous responsibility to march back 150 miles over two rivers when you're at the age of about 19 or 20. But they all did very well. The snag was that we were told that 4th Corps, under General Schoons, had crossed the Chindwin and had patrols, S-C-O-O-N-E-S, crossed the Chindwin, and that we would be received east of the Chindwin, and we had got home once we reached the Chindwin. So I told these officers and men that to aim due west until they reached the Chindwin, and there they would find the British Army. Well, unfortunately, the Schoons withdrew his forces from across the Chindwin. I don't know the reason, whether it was just bad liaison between Wingate's forces. Wingate, remember, you must remember, was in the middle of Burma. And 4th Corps. But it created a lot of bad blood later, and we felt that 4th Corps had let us down. Anyway, when we reached the Chindwin, different columns, different dispersal groups, we relaxed and eased up. I, in fact, having sent my party across, my party had gone further south, and I blew the railway in order to attract the Japanese onto me, and so as to make it easier for the other dispersal groups to cross the Irrawaddy and the railway. And we made good time after that, and we got to the Chindwin. There I actually got on a boat with some Burma Rifles, and stood up and drifted down the Chindwin, shouting to say that we had arrived. I stood up because I was wearing shorts. I wore shorts, and the Japanese didn't wear shorts, so that there could be no question of identification. Well, we eventually rendezvoused west of the Chindwin, and we met the Indian Army, who couldn't have looked after us better, and were astonished at the fact that we had been all over this place. My Sergeant Major Blaine, of the commandos, he made everybody march in and be properly and saluted and this, that and the other to show that we weren't a defeated unit, but we still had our morale right up. This created a good impression. But other dispersal groups, especially the young Gurkha officers under my command, they reached the Chindwin and relaxed and then got captured and rounded up by the Japanese, who used it as a stop line. Then they had 3 years or more in prison to think about this. And naturally they came out a bit embittered. And I wonder whether it wasn't that which started to create this bitterness, rancor, by certain of the Gurkha commanders against Wingate and the Chindits, which has acted without reason until this day. There's some who've got an appalling bitterness, including Brigadier Michael Roberts, who helped write the official history of the war in Burma. He went to such an extent that he said no Gurkha officer should belong to the Chindit Association. He's dead now, but I just don't know why he had this virulent bitterness against Wingate and the Chindits. One small point, when we got back, I saw General Schoons, whom I'd known, and he made me sit down, kept me for 2 or 3 days, when I could write down, when I was still red hot with my ideas and memories, all the points on patrolling which I could remember, having marched over 1,500 miles behind the Japs and through the jungle. I did this, and I don't bear any ill will about this. It was eventually published as Notes on Patrolling by General Schoons. But a young officer must realize that he's only part of a bigger machine. Now, casualties, I want to make one point. It was on Wingate's idea. When I had some wounded and